Well, hello, and welcome to the Growth Mindset Podcast. Join me, Sam Harris, on my journey of curiosity and growth. I have conversations with some of the world's most fascinating humans, from billionaires to Olympians, and most everyone in between, such as suspiciously happy people and even a hitman. Success isn't just for successful people, it is earned and you can earn it too. I find out how ordinary people become extraordinary to fuel your own growth mindset. Today on the podcast, I'm interviewing Stuart Chapman, who is one of the co-founders of Draper Esprit, one of UK's and Europe's leading VC firms. And they're one of the only VC firms, if not the only one, to have publicly listed. And yeah, they're a really cool company and they've got some good ethics. And it's just really interesting to break down how someone goes from being like a normal human when they were born to a VC company, which is just raising like stupid amounts of millions of money and putting them into big businesses. And it's just like a lot of big jumps, you'd think, but it's quite interesting to see how it kind of quite naturally happened from Stuart, just with like having a growth mindset, taking on new risks and things. They're a really cool company and they've backed a lot of big names like Grays, TransferWise, Free Trade, Revolut, and well, lots more. Anyway, yeah, just an interesting person and cool things that he's up to and just lots and lots of wisdom that he shares with us. So put on your thinking caps and buckle in. Welcome to the Growth Mindset Podcast. Today I have Stu Chapman on the podcast. Could you tell us a quick like 3-minute story?
Sure. So I was born to regular family and regular parents in a loving home in Eastbourne on the south coast. From there, I went to Loughborough University. Fantastic place. In fact, actually, I got back to Loughborough in that they come around to the alum asking for money. And I said, are you still teaching that venture capital course that you taught me? 1980s, I think. And they said, yes, one of our great courses. I said, well, either you got a lot better at it or you're still teaching the same old rubbish that you taught me. 2 weeks later, the dean of the school came down and said, I hear you've been rubbish in one of my courses. And that's not true. I've been in this industry for 20 years and yet you'd never asked me what it is. And yet I can make the textbooks come alive in terms of what real entrepreneurship is and how real people react. And so he said, well, you better come and join the advisory board. So for the last 10 years, I've been on the advisory board of Loughborough University in the business school. All about this connection with the working world to get real data in the hands of the students to complement the academic studies. I ended up through a graduate scheme at what was Midland Bank and now HSBC, and I was doing an arbitrage trading system. Today I would be called a business analyst. As a graduate of Midland Bank, you could jump to a graduate scheme of a sister company, and in 1992 I joined 3i. The venture capital company here in the UK. My big break at 3i came when, after you do your 18-month apprentice, they needed a CRM system to take a lead from first meeting all the way through to investment, all the way through to exit. They wanted someone from the investment stream to head up the project. At the time, 3i rewarded all of its investors by doing investments. So taking a step backwards and working in the IT team was not considered to be a great career choice for a venture capitalist. But I volunteered. I was a youngster. I didn't do no better. It found out that I was the only one who'd done any coding. And so it was a natural progression. But it turned out to be my biggest break, my biggest bit of luck. To sell the software to the users, I had to go meet all the directors. 3i was a fiefdom of offices, and the local director ran the local office as if it was his own entity. So they all had individual personalities and were all very charismatic. 1995, when I came back to the investment stream, every director that had a tech deal that came across their desk would say, that strange guy in London, he knows about tech. Give him a call. You don't need to be that good on tech history to realize 95, 96, 97, 98 were all kind of boom years. My reward for being part of that kind of boom period was I was given the opportunity to go to Silicon Valley and open up 3i's office. You're in California. I would say that's probably where my venture capital training really started. And I was there for 5 years, came back to the UK 2004. We came back because we had twins. And I really loved being in California, but I didn't love being part of a corporate, here in Europe. And so in 2005, I joined up with Simon Cook. And then in 2006, we founded Esprit. Venture capital firm invested in technology here in Europe enterprise, consumer, digital health, semiconductors. We did that for 10 years, standard format. 2016, we listed. Quite unusual thing to do for venture capital. Other people have listed funds. There's even some managers that are listed. But to list the funds and the manager together as a trading company is quite rare. We did it because we would get offered access to city institutions that wanted to participate in the entrepreneurial stage of growth and company building, but could only do it through public shares. And so we were a look through for them. 3 years later, we've grown and we haven't looked back. So I guess there's a snapshot.
Yeah, very interesting. Thanks for providing lots of food for thought. And I quite like your sort of initial sayings about going to the Loughborough Uni and sort of being like, actually, I can make it real for people, because that's kind of, I guess, what I'm trying to do with the podcast and like growth mindset. You started the podcast saying you're just like an ordinary person, and like you hear about exceptional people and you kind of think that like they were just always going to be exceptional, and like, but everyone starts just like a normal person. They just like, it's their choices and like their passion and drive that gets them there. It's just trying to show that people can like get to being extraordinary just by like what they do. It's not like you were born it kind of thing. And so it was a nice explanation of that. So then moving on to like 3i as a trainee and things, you said you sort of learned a lot about like VCs. Was it just like by default that you just happened to be like talking to them anyway? Or do you think that you also showed up in the right way besides just that you were there and they kind of knew that you were coding and things? Do you think that you kind of, also, did you like do any follow up? Were you always going to be like, oh, how else can I help you? And like, did you do anything yourself to open doors?
So, 3i was a unique organization. Mm. It was made up of small teams. And coming from Loughborough and background, you know, the analogy of sports teams and how good teams work together to play to one another's skills to win championships or to win titles is a simplistic way of viewing how a good team you operate. And so, I always enjoyed being that glue of a team. I was never a solo player. I was always a participant in a sports team as opposed to, you know, on my own individual skill. I worked very hard at keeping the team together. One of the hardest things at 3i was venture capital in 1992 was defined as anything risk capital. So what we might consider today as private equity or buyouts, it was all considered to be venture capital. So as a 25-year-old, I was being sent to the boardrooms of 55-year-old white middle-class men who didn't have to listen to young people. And so getting your voice heard meant that you had to develop skills, be their friend, be their confidant, be their value-add partner, be their recruiter, be their marketeer, be their advocate. So I learned very early on in my career that if I wanted to get anything done, you know, you had to work very hard, but you had to offer them value. So the idea of highlighting issues and trying to make it them think that they're seeing it themselves, you know, became a skill that you got taught quite early on at 3i. The 3i HR person told me that they hired on two qualities. They hired on people's empathy levels and they hired on their resilience. Venture capital is a bit weird in some ways in that you see so many businesses. But we only invest here in 12 new companies a year. Maybe 3,000 come through the door.
Mm.
So you're a professional sayer of no. So in that regard, I think that the two qualities that they hired on, I think still have their relevance today.
They seem pretty like overarching, useful. Are those the things that you hire on?
Yeah. I mean, the venture capital has got a bit more sophisticated, so you are looking for some domain knowledge sometimes, you're looking for some expertise. But once you've made the investment, you make the investment by winning the entrepreneur's trust. Once you've made the investment, you're maybe together for 7 to 10 years. And so I try and tell the young investors here, you know, that's 84 to 100 board meetings that you've got to make an influence. You've got to help them. It's a very different relationship than a financial relationship.
Yeah, I was going to ask, like, as a VC, because like some kind of difference, but how involved are you with the companies in your portfolio?
We're most definitely not operational.
So it's not like you help them with hiring or anything? But
we help them in hiring in a different way than you might imagine.
Mm.
So why would the best salesman in New York join a young British company?
Mm.
You know, if you think about the salesman's options. He can go to the most, the best well-known New York company, the best well-known US company, the best well-funded local company before he gets to a company he's never heard of. So our help in hiring in some ways is actually to provide the strength to the entrepreneur that he's funded, that he's backed. The salesman should look through the entrepreneur to the backers to see the other businesses they've backed and why this one will be successful. So it's definitely a most support function in that area. And the same with the fundraising. We do exactly the same. We provide the support to the entrepreneur. But at the end of the day, the entrepreneur is the person the investors are backing. I like to, the analogy I've used sometimes is like a stage show. No one will come to the stage show if the actors aren't there. But if you don't have stage hands, it's quite difficult to put a play on. And in that analogy, you kind of wear the stage hands.
Yeah, I like that. Makes sense. I like a good analogy.
It helps me because I'm not one for the spotlight, so I quite like being behind the curtain. So.
Yeah, that's interesting.
It matches my personality.
Yeah, it does make you think a bit. Because same as when I interviewed like the MD of Techstars, and it sounds like it's quite nice to kind of, you get to talk to lots of companies and sort of give them advice and come up with lots of ideas and be there creative and entrepreneurial the whole time. But you don't have to then go and execute on all the things that you're sort of advising or doing, and you don't have all like the low moments of like, oh, this is useless and stuff. And
you definitely don't have all the eggs in one basket. Yeah. I would say the hardest thing is for venture capital, young venture capital investors, is there's not that many financial success highs. So celebrate the success of a sale, celebrate the success of the first million. You have to do that. Because otherwise, it's a long road.
Definitely, yeah. But it still can be hard. Just for any entrepreneur, you're always looking forwards to what's next. So it can be kind of hard to like appreciate in the moment of how far you've come and stuff. And you're always aware of the things that are going wrong. So even when you are doing something really well, you're still like aware of the problems you haven't fixed. And so they're a human thing wherever you are. That's like where you are.
And I think as an attitude, it's the simplest thing I implemented in my 20s. Mm. Enable me to focus on small steps of progress rather than reflecting on failure.
That's a pretty timeless life lesson.
A story I was told was a US story, and I'm going to butcher it, so please forgive. But it was about the high-performing people of our business school class and how the best student got involved in investment banking because it was the highest paid, and that's what they were told the best student, the best opportunity to go to. And he went climbing his mountain. And at first it was great because he was earning loads more money than his peers. And then he started missing some key milestones. He missed some engagement parties. He got to the point where he was missing some weddings. To the point he said, no, that's it. I'm definitely going to this next wedding. Mm. And he flew into San Francisco late. He didn't have a hotel booked. And he ended up crashing on the couch of one of his best friends. And at 5 a.m. in the morning, the best friend was up and the best friend was coding. What are you doing? It's 5 a.m. in the morning. He said, oh, no, I've got to, this is my baby. This is the startup I'm doing. I'm going to change the world. And so he, curious and looking over his shoulder, and he started watching. The story, as it goes through, and when the gentleman tells it, it was actually the man was climbing the wrong mountain. He thought the highest peak was his peak, but actually when the cloud parted, the peak was actually in the distance. And the story I took away from it was that us as humans don't have a reverse gear. We much prefer to carry on going up, even if it's the wrong mountain.
Yeah, yeah.
Then actually go, this is the wrong, let's run backwards and run to the next mountain. And so that kind of stuck with me is, like as I do the careers advice to the 17, 18-year-olds and then go on to the graduates, is that between this period of 18 to 30, remember you have a reverse gear and try and run up as many mountains as you possibly can, because you will find the one whose peak is the highest for you, and that's where you will strive and where you go to. In some ways, my career has been a little bit blind. I just put one foot in front of the other, and in some it's been governed by my parents' advice. My mother is very practical and very aware of people's feelings and very keen about consequences of actions. My father's very resilient and never gives up. And so the kind of combination between the two meant I always felt that I was confident that I would succeed in whatever I did. So let's just put one foot in front of the other. I'm not sure that kind of maverick advice, you know, is really what students' parents want to hear.
Definitely.
But for me, it's at that young age, you're 20 to 30, we should climb as many mountains as we can.
Yeah.
It's not right. Reverse gear, let's go find another one.
I totally agree. They say you should be outside your comfort zone. Like, I think there's a zone of like things that I wouldn't tell my mum I'm about to do, but in hindsight she'll be really proud of, is like usually the best things I've done. So like, going to North Korea is, and so many people have listened to me, it's like it's part of a story that like people are interested in to hear about, but like trying to tell her that I was going to do that, she obviously would say no kind of thing, or like, she didn't want me to do my gap year, but then like had loads of cool stories and stuff. And every time I'm like thinking of starting a new business, I'm like, oh, you could get a job. And I'm like, yeah, but... And so it's a kind of a good gauge of like, but once I've done it, she's always very happy with me.
But this won't work with this audience. In 3i terms, the investment role was called a controller.
Mm.
You were meant to control the investment process. But my mum never understood what I did. And she associated the controller with the fat controller in Thomas the Tank Engine. A combination of physical attributes and a children's cartoon was how she pictured me in my roles. And if there's one thing I would stress to anybody, there's the value of mentors. And it doesn't have to be a formal program. I was very lucky in that I had people who looked out for me in all of my roles. It's hard to explain what the 1980s was like, but I had an older gentleman who was the corporate banker who took care of me and when I was a graduate at Midland. And he taught me the human side of your banking. He taught me that if you wanted to get an appointment with the CEO of a manufacturing company in Sussex and Kent, how you approached the receptionist staff or how you approached the people underneath the person you're trying to meet made all the difference to actually get to that appointment or get it into the right context, what you want to meet. So he taught me how to listen and then how to reflect back what I've been told. All the way to my mentor at 3i, he was really grumpy in the morning. I mean, really just not happy chap until several cups of coffee into the day. But his team would literally fight in the trenches for him. And that skill of, it's not about your personality in that regard, it's about what you do. And so he taught me that how you protect your team from the externalities, meant that their loyalty on the internal stuff, it was greatly, greatly enhanced. So we'd have situations where I might have made a small mistake or two. And I might have overpromised. And in the meeting where he was getting me out of trouble, he was 100% supportive, right behind me, managed to get me out with pride intact and no damage done. Back in the office, I got a ticking off and a kind of an education of how not to do it again. But my respect for him for not throwing me under the bus in front of people meant that I would work for him for nothing. Every mentor you have, you take forward. She wouldn't like me to tell you, but we the chairman of Draper's Brie, Karen, I always use her to bounce off life advice or career advice, because she's managed thousands of people in a massive corporate and been an entrepreneurial lady in her own right, investing her own money into projects, of tiny operations. And depth and breadth of experience add on to life means that I will always use mentors. It doesn't have to be a formal program. Just finding people that you respect and look up to and then actually using them to help.
I had mentors for my original business, and I've sort of like, I kept them on sort of afterwards, but I kind of went into like the last sort of years more of a phase of like just trying random different things and sort of traveling the world and sort of just finding as many different mountains and things just to like sort of see what they look like rather than actually to fully trying to climb them or anything. And so I found it was much easier to ask for a mentor when you're kind of specifically on a mission, be like, oh, I need really help with this, where it's like my whole life and you're a bit like, I don't know what I'm doing. Can be a bit harder, but have you got any advice for how someone in that kind of situation would find a mentor?
For me, it's always been a consequence of action. So I work with you, I build up trust. I'm quite open, so I genuinely believe if I give something of me to you, that you will give something of you to me. It has to be that way around. You know, I'm not expecting anything from you, but if I open up and share a fear or share a concern, then you will do likewise. And it's through that experience that I've made the connection with the people I've trusted. Obviously, the deeper the connection, the ability you can have life answers, questions and answers. And
yeah.
The more shallow is more professional.
Yeah, I think there's certainly like a whole part of this trying to learn to go a bit deeper as quick as possible kind of thing without going too fast because it's a bit weird.
And in my personal style, I think you set the own boundaries by how much you give. If I just want this to be a professional relationship, then I just give you an insight into my professional thinking. If I want to open it up, then you do it little by little, but you see what I mean.
Yeah, definitely. On the subject of being young and like success things, so then there's quite a few young people that become successful just because they start a business, or otherwise they kind of seem to have to follow more of the logical path, like being a banker, to kind of slowly get up their mountain. Is there any kind of examples that you know of people that become really successful, like become like a CEO or something of a company, but they didn't start the business, but they somehow like got to be there by like 30?
I don't believe there is a set path. When I spoke about entrepreneurship and how in 2006 it was my greatest buzz, well, why you were 36, why did it take so long? In my answer was, I've always thought I was entrepreneurial. I was working in a team of six, by and large, throughout my professional career. There have always been quite small teams. And so I always felt like I had maximum influence. I was always protected from party politics or from corporatism, or you know, the horrible parts that I don't particularly like. And so all I was incentivized to do was to perform to my best, come up with innovative ideas, some fail, some work, but just keep moving forward as a team. And actually, the bit when I got to 36 and we created Esprit, it was just because that was my window. That was our time in the sun, where the partners of Cazenove agreed a deal with the partners of JP Morgan, and some collateral damage of that transaction was our little division. And that was our opportunity, to go alone. I never had that opportunity before. I had opportunities to leave to go and work for another corporate, but that was never my motivator. And so it was something that I didn't plan. I didn't follow a route map to get there. But when the time came, kind of took that opportunity. So throughout our portfolio, there are numerous examples of founders who take the business so far and then pass on to your professional management team. If you read the research, a colleague of mine now works for Adam Street, and there's some research about how the success of founder-led businesses versus professional management. I always tell my founders that whatever their journey, be in charge of it. So like your example of your tech inventor, he was in charge of his journey and that he recognized his skill sets and made sure that he did the first outreach. Too many, the best situations I've always found is actually where the founder finds the right role for themselves and solves the problem themselves by looking in the mirror and recognizing the skill sets they need to fill. I always think that that always leads to the best success.
It's a hard one to sort of tell someone to do kind of thing, but it can be so much more useful for yourself if you kind of put yourself in like the sphere of what you're best at, and maybe you don't want to be in boardrooms the whole time and you do like doing other things. And
it's
natural.
From a Draper Esprit perspective, we try and get people to have a style to talk honestly and openly early. My son always describes it as in a cricket terms. I know this might not go so well for your international audience, but too many parents, are kind of not honest with their children when they're coaching them in sport. And my son was always, as the captain of the cricket team, listens to other parents say, "Don't worry, you got out to a good ball or whatever." And my son just missed it.
Yeah.
And that kind of honesty of, this is what I did wrong, but let's not worry about that. Let's worry about what I'm going to do next time to make sure it doesn't happen again. It's not a maturity thing in such that this young kid can pick it up. But it is, if you speak to people openly, honestly, and directly early, when it becomes difficult and you don't change your style, the message might be harder to take. But at least they have comfort that you're genuine. And so we try and tell people to always approach it, you know, in that way. When you make the original investment, everyone's happy and on a high. So that is your time to get the baseline of how you're going to communicate with people and get it accepted.
Otherwise, it sort of seems like you're taking a step back. Anyway, but so it's like, these are the things that you always need to think about.
Yeah. I really believe, you know, people don't like change. And if you change your voice or you change your behaviorism or you change the way that you, you know, it sends nervous signals. And so that's why there was a Three Eyes marketing campaign back in the 80s and 90s used to be a weekly calendar. And I think about A3 size calendar that was a cartoon. And I always like this boardroom picture of this chairman saying, honesty is the best policy. Let's call that option A. Now, what's option B? I always chuckled with that because I thought if I was never honest, I wasn't clever enough to work out what stories or what game I was playing. And so I learned very early that, you know, this is me. You know, and if I say this to you and you don't like it, I'm really sorry, but I'm saying it because I believe it. And I'm humble enough to know that I'm often wrong. So if I'm wrong, then please challenge me and then we can have a dialogue. And I found that if you got that in early enough and that they got comfortable with the way that you communicated and the way you behaved, then they trusted you when things got bad.
Yeah, which leads into, like, being a good mentor is like being able to establish trust and things, and also just full on the growth mindset attitude of just being open and honest to things and taking on feedback is just how you improve so much faster. And like, it's how you grow yourself rather than like having a fixed mindset of thinking that you're great and never being able to like take new things on.
I think feedback is great. I mean, there's a, you know, the feedback is a gift and you should accept all gifts.
Yeah, yeah.
Although some pairs of socks at Christmas are not the ones you want. I don't think people naturally love negative feedback. You know, it's, I don't wake up in the morning and think, gosh, wouldn't it be great if someone shone a light on my imperfections? So personally, I've developed a style where I can almost step outside of my body and look back at myself and hear the feedback and say, yes, you're right. You really should improve your communication, or you should improve your outreach. And that's kind of the way I've been able to deal with it. But I do think as an investor, one of the key attributes I look for is, can they listen? Their listening skills is, I think, a clear barometer of whether the thing's going to be successful or not. I mean, have you heard what I've said? And even if he disagrees with you, have you taken the 4% of nugget that I've given you, even if you disagree with the other 96%?
Yeah, I think that is one of the things that, I mean, I was always, I think, quite good at listening when I was young because I wasn't so good at talking. So I like got people to talk to me and stuff and try to just make the conversation as interesting as possible for myself, for something interesting to listen to. But I think when you're kind of young, people give you advice and things, it doesn't always feel like it applies to you, or they'll tell you stories about things that you don't quite conceptually realize. But I think as you get a bit older and you start giving other people advice, you can see the difference between when someone like listened and took it on and realized it versus when didn't. And then you kind of get the meta level of, oh, when I'm getting advice from my mentor, they actually know what they're talking about. You're like, crap, I actually really have to listen, because it's like the most valuable thing that we just learn by messing up, and can take a bit of a while.
I think you're getting your point across in a way that actually is succinct, easy to understand and easy to repeat, I think is a real skill.
People often ask me why I started the podcast, and there's lots of reasons, but I think I kind of wanted to have a voice and develop my skills to do that, because I've always been really good at listening and having opinions on things, and felt like I could be the person that sort of says the four sentences. Like, I've got like the idea there, but then like wasn't necessarily always so able to execute what I wanted to have come out of my mouth, kind of thing. And it's just been like really good practice to just get better at explaining things, I guess.
But I'm not very good at it.
I constantly
learn from the best to try and get more and more succinct and more and more.
It's really humbling to be in rooms with people who are super good at it, and you're like, oh, I thought I was good, but I'm actually really bad. Nice. So have there been any other kind of top life tips that you feel like you should share with people that maybe haven't come up, in terms of like maybe sort of more like relationship side of outside of work things? or just general life, anything else?
Like? So I listened last night to your podcast when you turned 30.
Oh, yeah.
Because I turned 50 about last week.
Nice.
And so it was topical, and I had a huge smile because it's completely relatable to the lady who's been with me since the Casino days. She came along to a party at home in where I was. And we were in a pub, and we had the upstairs of the pub. And the nice thing was that she says, your friends, they look like you. And there were friends from school, and there were friends from university, and there were friends from the town and stuff. And it was kind of reassuring that actually, if you are true to yourself, then actually the people that you pick up along the way of life's journey will have something in common with each other. The way they behave, and the way that they see fun, and the way that they make jokes. And that actually was really interesting, watching through the lens of someone else. She knew my mum and dad, obviously my wife, but she didn't know the friends from school, or the friends from university, or the friends from the town. I do think there is something about how stay true to yourself, because that's the people that you're going to take with you in life's journey. I think the biggest thing that I picked up was all about risk, and risk is neither good nor bad if you are risk averse or you're risk taker. It's just understanding it, understanding when you are outside your comfort zone is just as important as getting outside of your comfort zone. So I think that was something that came to me when we took Draper's Republic in 2016, and suddenly I was exposed to a whole new world of language that I had no idea what they were talking about. And it was only when I was able to get them to explain the underlying meaning of the acronyms they were using with me, or the terms they were using, that I actually found out I did all this anyway, or I knew how to do this. I just called it something different. But I perceived it to be quite scary risk, because these people were so much more knowledgeable than I were, and they were so much more skilled in the areas of public companies, until I had actually someone with me to explain it, and actually it's common sense, and it was well within my comfort zone, and actually I understood about governance, and I understood about risk, because that's what we did with Venture Capital. So that was interesting to me, the whole kind of, if you know where you are, it doesn't matter whether it's less risky or more risky. It's just knowing where you are on that curve.
Yeah.
I have been interviewing a lot over the last couple of years, obviously, to go from 12 to 40. And at the end of every interview, I found asking myself, what nonprofit would you be the CEO of? Because I actually found out that people's drivers are way above the why do you want to be in venture capital, why do you want to be in marketing, why do you be a podcast. And I'm 50, and it's taken me kind of 50 years to realize actually that if I can ask that question, I can get an insight into what drives people outside of the need to earn a paycheck to do what they want to do, was much more enlightening than anything else I could ask. I could ask what they did at the weekends, or I could ask what they did for fun, I could ask what sport they played. But actually asking people if they were given a 3-ride to be a CEO of a non-profit, what would they do? I have found to be one of the most enlightening questions.
Yeah, thanks. That is a question I like to ask people. This is what their favorite interview question is, and that I think might be my favorite answer so far. That's really good, because it's so true. Like, what is like your real driver behind things, and what would you be doing the rest of your time? I've been working on an idea. Basically, I've been like podcasting and listening to books and things a lot, and it's quite like a lonely pursuit, as in you do it by yourself. And because I want to make a thing that allows you to listen like in sync with other people, so you could like listen to like 3 podcasts a week with your wife, so that you can actually talk about the things you've listened to together. Or like if you listen to a book, you can kind of be in sync on the chapter. So like same as you might watch TV episodes together, like chapter by chapter, you can like talk about the whole thing. So if you listen to like a self-help book, you can actually talk about each of the things in each chapter and like think about the take homes, and actually like with your mentor, maybe like actually discuss what you're going to like implement, rather than just doing it by yourself, which is sort of, you listen to all these great things and ideas and it sort of stirs something to do, but then you never quite go and do it. And so it's just sort of, I think it make it a much more effective way of doing things, and it makes you feel more like socially connected to people. So there's quite a lot of loneliness, and like people want to improve their lives, and lots of people just listening to lots of content on the phone mindlessly by themselves. So it seems like it is quite, it's in like the right position to start getting adopted as a thing. So that's kind of my new business idea that I'm working on.
I like sports management and strategy. I see a game like a chess game. I love to know why people make the moves. And I read Eddie Jones's autobiography. It's on the plane. And the rugby guy. And the two things that really struck me that I would have loved to have your concept was the lengths he went to get 1% improvement. Were just phenomenal. I mean, just, and then on the flip side, I would have loved your technology was just to say to people, am I reading this right? That throughout his biography, he keeps making the same mistake. He targets the battle and he gets his team to the top of the hill to win the battle. And then the very next game, he loses the war. And so the beat in New Zealand in the semi-final of this year or last year's Rugby World Cup was the battle. But actually, the war was beating South Africa in the final. And when you read his autobiography, there's like four or five different times in his career where he's got to the summit. But not. And for someone who's, he's an educator. He was a teacher and then a principal, you know, of a school. And for someone who's such a thinker, is really interested in reading this book, and I would have loved to have hit pause.
Yeah.
I go, am I reading this right? is this South Africa example, is that exactly the same as these other two examples in his previous life?
It's so interesting when you kind of can have a conversation with someone else and see like how they interpret things. Because I've learned so much. It's like I said, I'm running a new podcast with a friend where we just read the same book a week and we kind of explain it to other people and like, talk about our top lessons and things. It's just so fascinating to learn like what someone else thinks about something, because you only ever get like your viewpoint and like how you read it, and like with text, like it's so easy to like misunderstand someone's text or something. It's but with a book you can still misunderstand like what someone's getting across and things, and just people like to think so differently.
I see you wrote the Phil Knight book. So it's a big book that's been going around here, Shoe Dog, and everyone's read it, and there's parts of his career where he went with the flow. And if you stopped him and said, why did you choose to create Nike in that way? Or that, it was like, it was just the next meeting or the next, And then there are other parts where he has most definitely taken a choice to go left or right. And I would have loved to have paused and gone, do you think that's a left and right decision? Or do you think actually he's just going with the flow? It's a wonderful book if you haven't read it or haven't read it.
It's on my queue of books to be reading, because it sounds really cool.
I read it because I could see some of myself in some of the decisions. Did you ever read Geoffrey Moore's Crossing the Chasm?
I may have read it when I was like sort of 23 years. It was in my list.
That's it.
And
it's a really simple book to read.
Obvious, but then it's
if you read a single chapter, you go, well, that's all.
I think it'd be one of the things that would be really good to revisit now and be like, oh yeah, I remember thinking this is really obvious and now I didn't do it.
And you put all 13 chapters together, and you go, that is genius. So.
Definitely. Cool. So just the last few questions. One is, what is one of your earliest ever memories that's kind of quite distinct?
So I can remember the sadness of not being picked for the football team. About 8 years old. I remember crying.
Yeah, sounds like an epic
crying
day.
Crying to my friends and the boys not been like, I don't quite know what to do with a boy that cries. Distinct kind of memory.
Thanks. And then finally, what is the kindest thing that someone has done for you?
The kindest thing, when I helped her, a CEO, acquire a number of businesses when I was at 3i, so we're talking in the 90s, and maybe 6 or 7 transactions we did together. So high volume of companies he was buying and selling, not all tech. So we had a professional relationship and it bordered on friendship, and he was maybe 15 years older than me, so he wasn't matey, but I helped him buy a business which actually ended up not having room for us to invest. There was an opportunity for us to buy a business. By the time the negotiations happened, he didn't need us. He remembered that, and when my wife was seriously ill, he repaid that kindness when I really needed it. When I really needed focus to do something else rather than sit in a waiting room in an intensive care unit, or when I really needed to get away from the situation. He provided that kindness. He probably would never describe it like that. He'd probably just describe it as I would do whatever anybody would do. But it was the one single act that I remember from that kind of period. And it was not monetary, it was not gifts, it was just time.
Yeah, it's really nice. It's just interesting to learn like different ways that you can sort of be kind in some of the things that maybe, like you said, like with the books where things seem obvious, but like actually you don't necessarily always do them when they present themselves. Yeah. And it's just nice to kind of have that like trigger to be like, oh, this is an opportunity to be like kind and useful, and often doesn't even cost you that much kind of thing.
The thing I remember is time. Mm. Someone gave me their time. As I said, I've recently celebrated my 50th birthday. Mm. One of the most memorable gifts I got. I'm a big Brighton supporter. Mm. My whole family are season ticket holders, and we go off to the Brighton. I got given a ball of wool in blue and a ball of wool in white and two knitting needles with a card that said, what do you get somebody who's got everything? How about a knitting pattern? I mean, it was simple in its execution, but in terms of what it meant, one, I'm still smiling today. I have no idea how I'm going to learn to knit, to make a scarf, to be able to give back to this person on their 50th birthday. I've still got to work that out. And so it's just the gift of time, I think, is probably the most precious thing.
Yeah, that was a really lovely conversation. Thanks so much for your time and giving it to give us all so much advice. Awesome. Is there anything that you want out of this, as in people should sort of do as an action or anything, or are you just kind of happy to be talking fun stuff?
I'm happy to meet you, Sam. I'm happy to partake, and no, I don't need anything.
Cool. Is there anything I can do for you?
Keep talking to people, keep encouraging them to be happy.
Mm.
And keep encouraging them to climb mountains.
Will do. Thanks so much.
Well, it goes without saying that I really enjoyed that conversation. So insightful. And unfortunately, I can't tell you everything of what happened afterwards, but it was one of those conversations where like I had to start packing up and leaving, but we carried on talking for sort of 20 minutes and it was really interesting. Before the interview started, I'd been trying to invest in a company called All Plants, which are like a vegan company that do sort of basically ready meals that you can have in your freezer, but they're really, really healthy and stuff. But anyway, I was having issues with it. And afterwards, he was concerned that I was able to make my investment because he was very of the opinion that like money needs to move to actually like make you rich, as in there's no point kind of just having money and savings. You have to be doing stuff with it. And he kind of went quite deep into his philosophies around that and investing and getting a good return on things. So yeah, he has some great views on kindness and like how to use mentors to get the best out of you. And also just, you know, how to kind of show up and maybe say not everything that's on your mind and kind of digest things a bit more and kind of come across as a more intelligent person in the room by saying less. It's quite useful. So yeah, lots of really useful opinions and like how to build a life. And you know, you always need to know exactly what direction you're going if you're just getting useful experience. And if you just always show up and are useful for people, it sort of can pay you back dividends in the long run. So that was some really good principles from Stuart, and very happy to have had him on the podcast. Congratulations on listening to a whole episode of the Growth Mindset podcast. Before you race into another podcast, try pausing. Ask yourself, what have you learned? What could you change? How will you make that change happen? Did you press pause? Knowledge is useless without action. What did you learn? What should you change? And how will you make that change happen? You can tell us what you learned by contacting us through the website, growthmindsetpodcast.com, and feel free to connect with us or our guests, or just peruse the show notes. Our Instagram is @growthmindsetpodcast, or follow me @samjamsnaps for a daily reminder to stop using Instagram. If you enjoy random acts of kindness and want to support the show, you can support us on Patreon or leave us a review on iTunes, and you'll make me very happy. And with that, keep learning and keep growing.